Hello, everyone. I'm very excited to be sitting here with Dr. Valter Longo, who's a professor of gerontology and biological sciences at the University of Southern California. He's also director of the Longevity Institute. Dr. Longo has made huge contributions to the field of aging. He has made significant contributions looking at the effects of fasting and other diets in the role of human aging and lifespan and biomarkers of health span, as well as looking at other metabolic fasting therapies for the treatment of human diseases. So, Valter, on the podcast, we've talked a lot about time-restricted eating from Dr. Sachin Panda's work and what the effects are of eating within a certain time frame, like at least a 12-hour time window that's in that corresponds with a circadian rhythm, and how that's really important for a variety of different metabolic factors because our metabolism is on a circadian rhythm, but also looking at the effects of having a longer fasting period when we're resting. So maybe you can tell us, you've done a significant amount of research on fasting in animals and humans.
Yes. So we are very interested in aging and really what are the interventions that extend longevity in a safe way. And fasting, periodic fasting, or better yet, fasting mimicking diets. So these diets that are designed to sort of trick the system and make it think it's fasting when you're not fasting. So that's what we focus on. And the idea really came from trying to substitute the calorie restriction, these interventions which require that people are restricted from calories permanently, essentially. And I always thought, I was a student of Roy Walford, who was one of the pioneers of calorie restriction back in the early 90s. And I was there when they went into Biosphere 2, which was this bubble essentially in Arizona where they did the first human study on calorie restriction. And the group, when they came out, it was a very stressed out group, very thin, right? So from then, I wanted to come up with something that was really for everybody, right? So how can you take that, have something as powerful, but that everybody can do? And that's where this fasting mimicking diet came about. And really about, anywhere from 4 to 1 week or longer of this changing to these diets, which is usually low in protein, low in sugar, and high in good fats.
And is that sort of, so it's low, we're kind of talking about this fasting mimetic diet, but the fasting itself is also something, so there's the fasting mimetic diet, which you've done a lot of research on in animals and also humans, but the fasting itself is different from caloric restriction, right? There's a lot of overlap between looking at the effects of different biomarkers for health span, but there's also some differences, right?
Well, it's very different, right? I mean, calorie restriction is, let's say, 20 to 30% restriction in calories. So you're basically eating all the time and you just happen to eat less calories. Fasting and periodic fasting are much more extreme, and we really use them to trick or manipulate the system, orchestrate a lot of genes to get it to do things like increase protection a lot or turn on stem cells. And so a lot of these things you can't get by calorie restriction, but you can get them by these more extreme interventions. And calorie restriction also is missing the biggest component of the periodic fasting, which is not fasting itself, but it's refeeding, right? So most people think of the restriction as what's working, but it turns out, as we've shown in a number of papers, that is the refeeding that is doing most of the work, right? So that during the, for example, when we publish on regeneration, the stem cells are turned on during fasting, but it is the refeeding that causes the rebuilding of the system. And so the most important part is the refeeding. And in calorie restriction, of course, you never have that. So it's really interesting how this works, and it's a very coordinated effect based on cycles of fasting and refeeding.
You mentioned the regeneration of the stem cells. So that's the study that you're referring to. You did this prolonged fasting for, I think it was like 48 to 72 hours in animals. And you showed that during that fasting state, the white blood cells were clear. They were basically, their populations decreased. And the reason they had decreased was because something was being activated called autophagy, which is the clearing away of damaged cells. And somehow, the autophagy that happened, you're saying that after that occurred, that was the signal for the regeneration of the stem cells, or
Autophagy is clearly occurring. This is established for fasting. But we don't think, what we've done so far was, now we're focusing more on autophagy. But what we've done so far, it was more about if you have an immune system, a complete immune system, that immune system has a lot of cells that you don't really need, right? Mm-hmm. So during starvation, whether you're a mouse, and now we know the same to be true for people, you have to get rid of a lot of cells, a lot of things that you don't need. And that's what's happening. It's not so much about autophagy, but it's more about apoptosis. And so programmed cell death. You're killing, essentially getting rid of a lot of cells. And then you stand by, you wait until food comes around again, and you rebuild it. So for example, in a mouse, about 40% of the white blood cells are destroyed during this period of 4 days of fasting or so. And then that 40% is rebuilt within a few days of refeeding, right? So it's really extraordinary. And probably the most powerful regeneration or generation program that you have since birth, essentially, right? So when a baby is first born, of course, you're generating all these systems. But then that never happens again. Right, not in that way. Like for example, the liver being generated, and the lungs being generated, and the heart, etc. So fasting is probably the most powerful, at least that we could think of, the most powerful way, particularly if it's prolonged, to shrink a system. Let's say make the liver a lot smaller, make all these organs a lot smaller, the immune system, and then regenerate it. Right. And so this is why we think it's so powerful, because it's not really the fasting that is doing anything. It's the body that is doing everything. The fasting just tells the body, I need you to kill all the cells. And then the refeeding gives the message, I need you to rebuild all mm-hmm. these systems.
This seems like it has, implications for human aging, because if you're talking about humans as we age, we something occurs called immunosenescence, where we start to lose some of our, we don't make as many lymphocytes. Actually, it's the lymphoid population that decreases with age. And so, if you're able to then be able to activate these hematopoietic stem cells to regenerate, the blood cell population, that seems like it would have implications for aging. But also, I thought you found something very interesting in that paper, and that was what we talked about with the regenerating the hematopoietic stem cells, which also increased in cell number, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly. You also did this experiment in older mice, and you showed something very interesting, I thought, because as we age, the immunosenescence seems to be happening, and I'm doing a huge oversimplification here, but it seems to be happening in the lymphoid cells, which are mostly B and T cells, as opposed to the other blood cells we have, the myeloid lineages, which are composed of neutrophils, macrophages, platelets, things like monocytes. So as we age, we have more of those types of immune cells and less mm-hmm. the other. But you actually found that if you fasted those animals, something happened with that population, correct?
Yeah, so we found that the lymphocytes number goes back to the more youthful level, and the ratio of myeloid cells to lymphocytes goes also back not to the same level as during youth, but certainly it moves in that direction. And so the profile of the immune system is much more similar to the young one. So essentially, we see rejuvenation of the system.
See, that was really cool for me when I was reading that, because I started thinking about, not only with the immunosenescence, how that seems relevant, because when you're older, you become, more susceptible to infections, cancer. Obviously, your immune cells play the first line of defense against killing cancer cells. But the other thing I thought about that was very interesting, and I'm not sure if you've probably read this paper, but it came out of Japan a few months ago. I don't remember the group, but they were looking at a variety of different biomarkers in the elderly population, in centenarians, in semi-supercentenarians, and in supercentenarians. And they looked at all sorts of biomarkers that are related to aging. So they looked at telomere length, they looked at senescence, immunosenescence, they looked at all sorts of inflammatory biomarkers. They looked at metabolic markers, glucose regulation, insulin sensitivity, they looked at kidney function, just tons of different biomarkers. And they were trying to find which biomarkers were consistent with healthy aging in all populations. So not just, to make it to centenarians, but to make it to every single age group. And what was identified was the only biomarker that was consistent with all the age groups was inflammation. So lower inflammation was predictive of vitality and cognitive function. And it was considered to be the only thing that was driving the aging process or that could predict mortality aside from age itself. And I was thinking about how monocytes, macrophages, neutrophils, these are the parts of the immune system that are the myeloid lineage, which is, we have more of them when we're older, they actually produce a lot of really nasty chemicals, hypochlorite, hydrogen peroxide. So the myeloid lineage is producing lots of nasty inflammatory chemicals. So it'd be kind of interesting to look and see. I mean, I'm totally just speculating here, but if there's some way, if you could regenerate the immune system to resemble more of a youthful phenotype, first of all, it'd be interesting to look at centenarians to see if they have more balance, right? If they have more of an immune system that has more lymphoid and myeloid, so it's not so asymmetric. That would be interesting to see, but also whether or not if that plays a role in healthy aging.
Yeah, I think we need to be careful with the inflammation and the as a cause of aging. I see it the other way around. I see it as the aging is the cause of inflammation, and that makes sense, right? Because inflammation is really can come from dysregulation of immune cells and other cells in the body. So so I think it's. Really, the evidence that inflammation is the driver is not there. There's very few studies actually showing that, by increasing a little bit inflammation, increasing aging, they're not there. It's possible, but this doesn't seem likely. I look at it as much more in the sense of program, meaning that all organisms have a program, and this program is there to keep them healthy and young. Up to a certain point, and now there are ways to make these programs longer or shorter, and I think the centenarian just happened to have programs that are stronger and longer, and then when these programs fail, the inflammation is one of the things that you see as well, and it happens together with a lot of other problems, but certainly inflammation, as a marker is a very important one. So if you look at C-reactive protein, for example, or interleukin-6, in an intervention that you do, you want to see them coming down. And this is a good indication, as we've done for our fasting mimicking diet, where we show that almost every patient, we showed a decrease in inflammation in the mice that were given the fasting mimicking diet starting at middle age. But we also saw it in the population, in the human population, age 20 to 70, where everybody that had high C-reactive protein came back down after 3 cycles of the FMD, came back down to their normal levels. So, but again, that's probably indicating that the systems were not working properly, and now you're bringing them back so maybe you're regenerating part of the bone marrow, and maybe also you kill some bad cells in the spleen, et cetera, et cetera. And so the result of that is less inflammatory markers that are being released. The liver also, we've shown that it undergoes cycles of atrophy and regeneration. So all of these organs are contributing to inflammation. And so it's important that with an intervention, you see also an effect on inflammation, because it tells you that the intervention is working, the system is being reset back to a more youthful state.
Yeah, I do agree that's definitely a good marker. So you were talking about this fasting mimetic diet in humans, this clinical study in humans pilot trial that you had done in humans, where you're, is there, so with the mouse studies and the fasting and the autophagy and the regenerating of the stem cells, and you know, that stuff's all very exciting and has relevance for, you know, for cancer and for aging in general. But how can you translate like a 48-hour fast to humans? And is that sort of why you've come up with this fasting mimetic diet? Because the amount of time would have to be like a week or 5 days or something that seems a lot more difficult for humans to do.
Yeah, so it's not just about difficulty, it's also about safety. And so when we first started with the fasting in cancer patients, basically the patients didn't want to do it and the doctors didn't want to do it. So it's really a struggle, and it took us forever here at the Norris Cancer Center, our own university, to get 18 patients to go through it. It took us like 5 or 6 years. So it was very difficult. And then we started asking people, what if we gave you a fasting mimicking diet? And we started asking doctors, what if we give patients a box and it has all the foods that they need? So it's more of a medicine, right? You just hand over to the patient a medicine. And then everything turned around. So people were much more likely to do it. They felt like
some more compliance.
Psychologically, we give them something. They also, of course, they're eating almost normally. I mean, normally in the sense at the right times. They're not eating normally. Obviously, the diet is very different than the normal diet. And the doctors felt good about it. So I think it was really important to get the fasting mimicking diet going. And, you know, so now we have a number of trials, both in cancer patients, in diabetes patients. Soon enough, we'll start with, we finish one in multiple sclerosis. So now we're ready to start talking to the FDA about moving to the next level. I think people are underestimating the power of this. And that's good and bad, I guess. But I think that it's got real potential. As we're seeing now that we're talking to doctors, and now we're seeing a lot of doctors, cardiologists, endocrinologists, gynecologists, prescribing it, right? Or recommending it. They're not prescribing, it's not a drug, but they're recommending it to patients. And it's been great. You know, now we have a couple hundred doctors that we're talking to, but to see this group of people change from this drug centered mentality to maybe there are things that that we didn't realize could be very powerful and much more able to, again, let the body fix itself. And so I would not be surprised if in 10 years worldwide these type of interventions are going to be standard in the doctor's office.
Wow, that's really cool. You know, it's really diet, lifestyle, they play a really big role in cancer. I mean, it's pretty well known that things like obesity, smoking, you know, being sedentary, they all increase the chance of getting cancer. And, you know, these people are getting cancer more and more these days. I know that it's the second leading cause of death in the United States. And I think actually recently, according to the newest CDC data, the state of California, it's the leading cause of death. It trumped heart disease in the state of California. Right. So
in Europe, it's the same way in a lot of places.
In Europe,
it's number one.
Really? People smoke a lot in Europe. But, you know, the cancer treatments, so the standard of care, you know, chemotherapy, radiation, surgical, you know, interventions have sort of been the same for quite some time, several decades at least. So I can't think of a better time than now for these metabolic types of interventions to make their way, hopefully, into standard care, either with standard care or possibly replacing it to some degree in the future.
Yeah.
But you did a clinical trial, so are you involved in this clinical trial that you kind of mentioned, like, briefly, which I thought was very interesting, the actual one with fasting, where the cancer patients fasted either before or after the chemo treatment, and I thought it was very interesting that you found, maybe you can talk about it, but you found that their normal cells were more resistant to the stresses of chemo, whereas the cancer cells were more sensitized to that.
Right. So, of course, all of this starts in mice, and in mice we were able to show very strong effects, what we call differential stress resistance, which is you protect the normal cells, but not the cancer cells, and then something called differential stress sensitization, Well, you kill the cancer cells, but not the normal cells.
Can you explain that a little bit, like why that is?
Yeah. Well, that is, again, because the almost every organism, you can start with E. coli, actually, bacteria, and then move to simple organisms like yeast and all the way up to mice. They have starvation responses, right? So if you starve any system, virtually any system, they'll go into this shielded mode, protected mode, and then they sit there until food comes around again. So in this protective mode, they're very resistant to all kinds of things. They're resistant probably because they have to be resistant to the sun and to chemicals produced by other microorganisms that might be surrounding them. And so then they happen to also, at least mice and now we think humans, chemotherapy is also one of the toxins that they're resistant to. So you starve them, the normal cells go into the protective mode. When you starve a cancer cell, though, because the oncogenes are the regulatory genes of this protection, cancer cells, by definition, can never respond, right? So they're just normal cells respond no matter what normal cell it is, from a muscle cell to a hepatocytes to a brain cell, but the cancer cells don't respond. And that's really what's called differential stress resistance. In the differential stress sensitization instead, it really has to do with something that I think was underappreciated, which is a cancer cell is viewed as a smart cell. In fact, the cancer cell is a very dumb cell. And why is it dumb? Because it is evolved in all this high nourishment environment, right? So it's evolved with a lot of proteins, a lot of amino acids, a lot of sugars, a lot of growth factors. All these things are around all the time. So by making them available, I know that oncologists mean well, right? But by making all this available during chemotherapy, you're really helping one thing more than anything else, is the cancers, right?
What you're referring to is them telling people to eat a lot of calories.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah, so they tell them. And so, you know, because the cancer loves sugar, it loves amino acids, right? And depends on sugar and amino acids. The more you give it, the happier it is. And also, these nutrients make the normal cells sensitive, right? So you're making the normal cells sensitive and you're making the cancer happy, right? Instead of the opposite, which is make the normal cells protected and make the cancer cells miserable. Why are the cancer cells miserable? Well, because again, having evolved in this abundance, once you take the abundance away, it's like almost saying, imagine somebody that had a very low IQ, looking for food, you know, and if you make it available, it's easy. Let's say, thinking about a monkey, a monkey that has got very low IQ, and you put it in front of food all around it, and it's gonna have no problem, right? As soon as you take the same monkey with a very low IQ and you make it extremely difficult to find the food, now that monkey is going to have a problem. And that's how we see the cancer cells. You know, once the amino acids are low, the growth factors and the sugar are low, the cancer is going to struggle. And then if on top of that you hit it with chemotherapy, it just has a very low chance of escaping. This is why in mice we see cancer-free survival, meaning that mice are free of cancer only when we combine the starvation or the fasting-mimicking diets with the chemotherapy. We almost never see it when we use each one alone, right? Mm-hmm. We and many other labs have tried that. You see, which is great, often the fasting or the fasting-mimicking diets are as good as chemo, but you never see each intervention alone being curative. So it's very interesting. And this is also very important to point out because a lot of people tend to either be in the camp of traditional medicine or in the camp of alternative medicine. And people don't understand that, both of them are very important. And when you combine it, particularly the alternative integrative medicine that's got a deep scientific foundation, when you combine it, now you have a very powerful system in your hands. And whereas each alone doesn't work very well.
Yeah, so it's kind of like what you're explaining, to, at least the way I'm understanding it, is that you need, so the fasting itself is a stressor, but you need another stressor because the stress plus the stress is what can push the cancer cells to the death, right? So they're, in a way...
Yeah, I don't see it. I mean, I don't really see it as a stress.
Fasting?
Yeah, I really don't see it as a stress. I see it more as an environment that... is very common, right? It's very common to bacteria. Is more common, in fact, than food, right? So you can see food is a bigger stress than fasting, right? Because food really puts you in a weak position, right? And fasting puts you in a strong position. So if you look at most organisms on the planet, they're much more under starvation condition than they are, including humans, right? Like historically. If you look at, there's some really nice books about, the medieval times in Italy and even after. And it's amazing how many times they were without food at all. Right? Mm-hmm. They could without food for months. And this was very, very common for everybody. Imagine before then, imagine tens of thousands of years ago, we must have gone without food for really long time. So fasting is part of the normal world. It is the normal world. And food comes around once in a while, and then you go back to fasting. But you have to respond to that, and you respond by having entering a mode of survival that is very different from the one that you enter or you stay in when you have plenty of food around.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I think what I kind of was trying to convey was that it activates stress response pathways because, even though it is part of our normal, obviously throughout human evolution, we've been through periods of time with, no food and starvation. That is normal. It is part of our normal, it is part of our normal biology, I guess. But yeah. I think that because it activates all these stress response pathways in a way.
I mean, worldwide, technically, it is a stress. I mean, it's viewed as a stress. But I guess that's...
Like a hormetic type of stress is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but that's the one that I have a problem with, meaning that the hormetic stress is really something that you activate by having some type of damage or problem that activates a response, and then that response makes the system more
stronger,
protected against the bigger problem, right? And but here I view it more as program A, program B type of thing, right? So program A, the major program, is the starvation program where you are in a shielded mode, right? Your decision is let's be in a long-term protected mode. And program B is when you say, when the organism makes the decision that it doesn't need to be in a protective mode because it really wants to focus on reproduction, on growth and reproduction. So I think it's better to view it this way because I think a lot of people, by going into the hormesis theory, maybe miss a little bit of the point. And I know a lot of people would disagree with me on this, but really by doing the work in like we have done in E. coli, in yeast, in human cells, in mice, and in humans, you start getting a more clear picture of what's going on. And I really see it as A and B, the environment decides which program you adapt.
That's an interesting way to think about it. Getting back to the cancer with the fasting and this kind of, we got sidetracked, but the fasting, the cancer cells itself, so doing this in animals, and also you've been involved with in a clinical trial where it was shown to lower, markers of damage in human blood cells. DNA damage was lower, but the cancer cells were more sensitized to death. In animal studies, you showed that because of the fasting lowers glucose levels, and like you mentioned, cancer cells love glucose. That's called the Warburg effect, where they're predominantly using glucose. Of course, they also use glutamine and amino acids. But I thought it was also, very interesting because I've often thought about cancer cells as being primed to die. You mentioned how oncogenic signaling is all screwing up all sorts of, they're damaged, they're messed up cells, they're not normal. And they have high levels of, pro-apoptotic proteins that are causing them, they're supposed to cause them to die, but they've countered that with the anti-apoptotics. Mm-hmm. And all it really, so it's almost like they're primed to die, but they need that just extra stress, whether that's from chemo or possibly from activating mitochondria, which are the largest producers of reactive oxygen species. So do you think that part of the fasting of the cancer cells and sort of causing them to then use fatty acids, which can only be used by the mitochondria to generate energy, as a byproduct then making reactive oxygen species, do you think that's part of the killing, I mean, in addition to the immune system, which you also showed?
Yeah, I think it's all connected. You know, I think it's all connected. So yes, we published a paper calling it the fasting-dependent anti-Warburg effect. Mm-hmm. And so basically, normally, the cancer cells can rely on glucose. And once the glucose is lower, they have no choice but to try to go back to oxidative phosphorylation and using the mitochondria to get energy, because there is no other way around it, right? And that's great, because they become desperate, essentially, and that condition makes them undergo suicide, because now, like you said, you know, you produce a lot of free radicals, but the cell is not set up to be protected. So it's a very bad combination, and this leads to the extensive death, and then in mice can cause cancer-free survival. But also we think that probably that is involved in allowing the immune cells to move in and kill them. Or it allows the cells to become more immunogenic, so that now they're easier to be recognized by dendritic cell, etc., and to be set up to cause an immune response than normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you actually showed maybe it was the fasting mimetic diet itself was able to increase cytotoxic T lymphocyte number, and play an important role in killing cancer cells.
Yeah, not just increase the number, which that is very much consistent with our older paper, but more so making the cancer cells exposed to it, right? So it's more about making the cancer cell more unable, like you were saying. Now, normally the cancer cell figures out how to deal with the immune system and has mm-hmm. proteins that say, I'm one of yours, mm-hmm. right? And tricks the immune system in that sense. And so the fasting takes that away. And this is really, again, interesting, because it is this coordinated, multi-level approach that the fasting is causing, which makes you think, again, that some of these programs, some of these effects may have been evolved effects to get rid of, let's say, of precancerous cells, right? Because fasting was something that was normal for human beings, kind of like sleep. And maybe it was utilized for protection. And then eventually when we stopped doing it, we lost this feature. We lost this help that the fasting had always given us. And maybe that also caused us to be now exposed to this very high incidence of diseases that we earlier did not have.
Do you practice fasting yourself?
Yes, of course. I practice fasting. I don't normally eat lunch, but I just finished a book, which was published in Italy, and it's gonna follow here in the U.S. And in it, I talk about the need to use this in a flexible way, right? And this is gonna have to be the future of nutrition, and I think nutritionists and dietitians and doctors are going to have to get used to this. For example, I say if you're overweight or obese, or you tend to gain weight, then you have to go to this 2-meal-a-day program, like breakfast and lunch or breakfast and dinner, okay? As I did for 15 years. Then if you underweight, though, you can't do that anymore. So you have to go back to 3 meals a day, right? So you have to use fasting and time-restricted feeding, mm-hmm. and such in Panda's work, which I also utilize for that purpose, you know. And so keep the feeding to 12 hours or less, and then decide the meal frequency. And Sachin and I just wrote an article on this, and to control the weight. It's really important, and particularly control visceral fat. So we hope that that's what doctors start doing, and say instead of give simple solution, because 2 meals a day may not be easy to follow, but it's a clear rule, right? And that's what people need. You can say, I go for it or I don't, but if I do go for it, it's going to work, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas now we have a system where it's almost impossible for anybody to regulate. When you tell somebody eat 5 or 6 times a day, it's almost impossible to regulate what somebody eats, right? By making it 2 meals a day, then you have much higher control, and that can serve to, in time restriction and 2 meals a day, they can serve to regulate the amount of calories as such and as shown for the time restriction. So now we need to do more studies on meal frequency, but of course this is likely to get the same similar effects.
Do you think it's more important, so within, if you're eating within this 12-hour window, which is coordinated with the circadian rhythm, and if you're eating 2 meals, do you think that you'd get more benefits if you had the 2 meals closer together, because then you, in theory, would be fasting for longer, you'd have, more beta-hydroxybutyrate, ketone bodies, things that are, being produced upon a prolonged fasting, or do you think
I spent, 25 years since the Walford days, and I would say I learned one thing, and also being Italian and spending a lot of time around the world, I learned that you cannot take happiness away from people, So I always stayed away from trying to regulate too much, too close, mm-hmm. 2 hours apart, what do you got to eat? So I think we always start with, how can we keep you as close as possible to what makes you happy while optimizing the longevity aspect? So I never started doing that because I know that people are not going to do it. Just like calorie restriction. Calorie restriction has been around for 100 years and nobody does it, right? I mean, maybe 1 in 1,000. I'd be surprised if it's even that, right? Yeah. Maybe 1 in 10,000, right? So after 100 years of calorie restriction research, 1 in 10,000 Americans maybe are doing calorie restriction. So I think that it's important, for example, with the 2 meals a day, there's a lot of people that have done that on their own, right? There's a lot of centenarians. If you go to Loma Linda or you go to Okinawa or you go to Southern Italy, a lot of people say, yeah, I eat twice a day. That's okay. So that told me that from the beginning that there was something that was doable and people even doing it in a voluntary way. In anything else, start regulating, you should eat four. And also 12 hours, I think a lot of people did that kind of time restriction, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when I grew up, that's how we did it. Maybe at breakfast at 8 a.m. and then 8:30 at the most, you finished, and that was it. And so I think that's important to not try to push for every inch of the longevity plan and really, because people will abandon it. That's another thing we shore up, If you tell them to do things that are very much not in tune with what they're used to, they'll do it for 6 months and then they'll never do it again. Yeah. This is why the skipping meals, because a lot of people do it, and when you switch to it, that's just an easy thing to do and you can do it all the rest of your life. And then the periodic fasting mimicking diets, because also it's not very invasive, and people say, every 3 or 4 months I'll give you 5 days like that. Make it simple for me. Don't make me don't make it too low calorie, make me eat, but I can do it. So I think it's, if we want the masses to do it, it has to be the technology and the safety, et cetera, has to match their needs. And I think that's where the effort should be put in, rather than trying to regulate everything, how right. people do everything.
Right. Compliance is very important. So do you, eating within a certain time frame and eating 2 meals a day actually is what I do. I usually try to eat within a 10-hour, yeah. And I fast for about 14 hours. But I'm really interested in the autophagy benefits and in the stem cell, being able to make more hematopoietic stem cells. And I'm wondering what a human would have to do to get, is my 14 hours of fast every night doing that, or do I have to do a 4-day prolonged fast, which I can't, I wouldn't do that, unless I had some sort of supervision or possibly this fasting mimetic diet, which you mentioned, you've shown in several different studies in many different ways mimics fasting, and it's this low sugar, low protein, high fat diet. So, you know, is that something that...
Yeah, I think there are different advantages. I mean, there's obviously some overlap. So I would say if you're on the perfect diet, which is a vegan pescatarian diet, low protein, high nourishment, and then like I do all this, like 2 meals a day, 12-hour restriction, which, and then the rest that I just said, if you're on that, you're not going to need as many fasting mimicking diets, right? But the fasting mimicking diet pushes you into a mode that you don't normally get with all these interventions. Why? Because overnight, most of that 14 hours, you got some glycogen to burn, right? So you're not really needing to do much of a switch to anything else. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And I think it's good. You know, shouldn't go over that. Because it's just a continuous thing. You know, you don't want to push the system too much into these extreme modes all the time. It's different from the fasting mimicking diet because, as I said, you know, the fasting mimicking diet really, by day two of the diet, and only by day two or so of the diet, the system starts switching to a ketogenic mode. You start burning visceral fat as your major source of energy. Your brain starts moving from burning sugar to burning ketone bodies, you know, beta-hydroxybutyrate. As I said, everything starts shrinking. The immune system starts shrinking. The liver, the heart, even the oligodendrocytes, as we've shown in our multiple sclerosis paper. So that you're not going to get with anything else. And you're only going to get it with this prolonged fasting-mimicking diet. Now, is it possible that if you did some of these things many, many times, that this would be equivalent to a fasting-mimicking diet? Yes, possible. But again, we've seen that we don't know, you know, because theoretically there shouldn't be enough because you're never going to get to this shrinking and rebuilding. But even if it was like that, then I think that it's hard to change people's behavior all the time. So we felt that by doing these periodic interventions, we get a much better chance of getting there.
You mentioned the multiple sclerosis with your fasting mimetic diet and also the fact that this diet sort of shifts you to a more fat-burning state, which is sort of in line with, it's definitely in line with ketosis, which you can get from fasting, but also in line with people that are doing a more ketogenic type of diet. And in your clinical study with people with multiple sclerosis, or was it in the mouse, one of the studies you had, I think it was the human study. You want to talk about that? You had a ketogenic diet. You had the fasting mimetic diet.
Yeah, we did the same in mice and human, right? So it was a fasting mimicking diet and ketogenic diet in both cases. And in the mice, of course, we could demonstrate some things and these very clear effects, which was the fasting mimicking diet causes the white blood cells, so the immune cells, as I mentioned earlier, to be destroyed, partially destroyed. And then it turns on the stem cells. And when you make new cells, of course, they're no longer autoimmune, right? So the original cells are autoimmune. They're attacking the oligodendrocytes in the spinal cord. Mm-hmm. The new cells, we've shown, they're no longer immune. And these lead to about 20% of the mice being disease-free, right? So meaning 20% of the mice are cured from this autoimmunity, which is very much like multiple sclerosis. The other thing that happens is that the oligodendrocytes, with the inflammation, goes down, right? So meaning the general inflammatory state around the spinal cord particularly goes down. And so this is very important because it allows the progenitor cells, so the ones that give rise to new myelin, so they rebuild the spinal cord, they can now do their job and regenerate the system. So now, again, you have, as I mentioned earlier for cancer, you have this coordinated effect, which you take the bad cells, replace them with the new cells, and then block the inflammation, rebuild the spinal cord. Now you can say, well, this is incredible. This is magic, right? Well, again, it's not. It's just that the body has to have this ability, like you cut yourself. The system that goes to work is incredible, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like saying, you know, if I found a way to regenerate part of my arm by fooling the system into thinking that it just got cut everywhere, mm-hmm. right? That's, if you want to see fasting, you can see it like that. And that's why it looks so magic, is because it is an evolved process that has been, you know, been evolving for billions of years, and so it knows exactly what to do to fix a series of problems.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can see the wound as a, you know, in the spinal cord, as you will see as a cut, you would think of as the cut of in the skin.
Wonder. I had this thought I want to say, but also you showed people with multiple sclerosis had improvements according to some test or something as well, right? Yeah. With the fasting mimetic diet and also the ketogenic diet, which...
Yeah, and also the ketogenic. Less so with the ketogenic diet. Mm-hmm. And this is Markus Bock in Berlin that was the lead person in the study. The amazing thing is that a week of fasting followed by a Mediterranean diet, which is really a regular diet, did better than 6 months of ketogenic diet, right?
Oh, wow.
So continuous, right?
Okay.
That's what makes it very impressive.
So it was 1 week of fasting mimetic diet.
One single time, right?
Yeah. 5 days and then 25
seven
days.
Days.
Of,
yeah.
7 days.
And 7 days.
The rest of Mediterranean.
And then the rest of the 6 months, a regular Mediterranean diet.
Oh, really? Just one?
Yeah.
Wow, that is
this is
impressive.
What makes it remarkable, you know. So now we're approaching the FDA, and I think we're going to propose one cycle every 2 months, so hopefully that
for another trial, for another clinical.
A much larger trial. Yeah.
Is this something that it can be available to physicians that are treating people with multiple sclerosis, or oncologists that are treating cancer patients? Because you've shown that this is a very powerful metabolic therapy that can be used to, honestly, it seems like if we're talking about getting rid of damaged cells and replacing them with the new fully functional ones, it can be applied to a lot of diseases.
Yeah, there is no doubt. Yeah. So we're now doing mouse work in many autoimmune diseases. For example, we're doing in cognitive diseases. Yes, I think that what we are saying now to clinicians is the following, and to patients is the following. And sometimes we get attacked for this, but I really feel that this is the way to do it, which is if there is a treatment, whether it's multiple sclerosis or another autoimmunity, or a degenerative disease or diabetes or cardiovascular disease, I mean, all these things we tested in some way in clinically. But if you can wait, because there's something that works already very well for you, then wait, right? You shouldn't try something. This is not fully tested, meaning that we don't have a, yes, this works. You only get that when you do 2,000 patients, or, you know, I say at least 1,000, right? And then you have to look at the statistics, you have to look at the response, et cetera, et cetera. We're not there yet. So we're saying, if you can wait, wait. If you cannot wait, because, you know, you have multiple sclerosis and you cannot take it anymore, or you have cancer and you're stage 4, or even you're stage 1 and you're getting devastated by the side effects. So go to your oncologist, your cardiologist, your diabetologist, your immunologist, whatever, and say, I can't take this anymore. This is not working. And of course, there's got to be a decision made by the clinicians together with the patient saying, you know, should we take a risk in adding to this fasting mimicking diet to the treatment, and that's, you know, together they have to come up with an answer. Is it worth the risk? And to some people, it is. You know, we've had some people with Crohn's disease. They said, you know, I can't wait anymore, and they did it, and they did extremely well. You know, after the fasting mimicking diet. You know, so we haven't published that yet, but and so I think same for multiple sclerosis and all these diseases. You have to see where you're at. Can you wait? Can you not? Is there something that is working, and then make the decision on is it for now or is it for, you know, 5 years from now?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Walter. I want to kind of go back to this thought that you instigated in my mind when you're talking about this sort of like wound healing sort of analogy, and that is at least with the hematopoietic stem cells, like I'm not sure about with, you know, other stem cells in other tissues, but I know that they, when they're quiescent, when they're not dividing, they are glycolytic, meaning they use glucose for energy because they don't want to damage themselves with reactive oxygen species being generated from, you know, as a byproduct of mitochondrial function, right? But I do know that when they come out of quiescence and they come out to either self-renew or differentiate into progenitor cells, they become oxidative phosphorylation becomes their source of making energy. And so I'm wondering if there's what the signal, I know you've published some studies on looking at different signaling pathways that are required to cause this hematopoietic stem cell self-renewal mechanism, but I'm wondering if possibly just not having the glucose available and having just the, you know, fatty acids, the source of energy that can only be used by mitochondria, if that somehow also is playing a role in making them self-renew more or differentiate more.
I think so, and this is the work by David Sabatini and others at MIT, and they're doing work on the fat and the role of fat and fatty acids, etc., on self-renewal and on the activation of stem cells, particularly in the gut. So, yeah, there seems to be a role for fat in that, and I think it's still. We're still beginning to understand it. I think obviously with fasting, you produce fat and you produce fatty acids and glycerol and ketone bodies. So the environment is there and we need to maybe understand more how each component that is changing is affecting the program. So we made the decision to try to, I think things are going very slow and we've always been very interested in people that have a problem now, right? Instead of,
right.
You know, a lot of people are like, well, you know, in 20 years we'll have this. And we always said, you know, there's people that have cancer now, they have multiple sclerosis now, so what do you do for them, right? And so our decision has been always understand enough the mechanisms to be able to not or minimize the chance of making mistakes. Get to the disease, get to the clinical trial, and then go back and fill it in, right? Rather than step by step by step by step, you know, and then it'll take you 15 years to get to the clinical trial. So, yeah. I'm not criticizing the other method, but I'm just saying that for us has been get the mechanism, get enough mechanism, move to the clinical trial, and then make sure it's safe.
It's been fantastic. I mean, you've been able to translate so many different studies. I mean, it's really quite phenomenal. I'm just sort of thinking, in fact, I just thought about it when you were mentioning the ketone bodies too. Well, ketone bodies are a more, if you think about the stem cells and if they need energy to differentiate or self-renew, ketone bodies would actually provide a very energetically favorable source because it takes less oxygen actually to convert beta-hydroxybutyrate into acetyl-CoA as opposed to glucose into pyruvate. So if you think about it, it's more energetically favorable to have ketone bodies. And so maybe it also helps just because it takes less energy to do this process. I mean, you know, it's possible, but...
Yeah, you know. I think there's also mechanisms. Again, the fasting imposes this new metabolic profile. And the new metabolic profile requires the stem cells for this regeneration that I mentioned. So if you gotta get rid of half of your liver, let's say that you fast for a month and a half, right? Then you must you will produce tons of fatty acids and tons of ketone bodies, and that environment is gonna require the stem cells to be renewing and being standing by for the day where you need to make a new liver, essentially, or health of the liver, right? So this is why I think it's all a part of a coordinated response where, you know, you have the fat. And by then, the fat is one of the few sources, abundant sources of energy also for the stem cells. So they really have no choice but to be ready to respond to fat metabolites so that they can self-renew because there's not much sugar around and the brain needs the sugar, right. By the way, right? So the brain needs a lot of the sugar that is available. A lot of it is made by gluconeogenesis. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense.
Red blood cells need it.
Yeah.
since they have no mitochondria.
Right, and so it makes sense that you will have a system like that that is fat and fatty acid and ketone-based.
Absolutely. Not to mention that, like, you know, beta-hydroxybutyrate's been identified to be a signaling molecule as well. I think Eric Verdeen's work at UCSF showed it's a class 1 histone deacetylase inhibitor. I mean, who knows what's going on. But I wanted to ask you about back to the cancer and, you know, this fasting cancer, fasting mimetic diet and cancer, a couple of things. So one is, you know, I think you've shown without a doubt that this, that in both animals and also in some preliminary work in humans, that the fasting or the fasting mimetic diet can sensitize cancer cells to standard of care, whether that's chemo, radiation, whatever, you know, death, while still protecting the normal cells, which are upregulating all sorts of protective pathways, as you mentioned. But there's this whole other field that I'm familiar with, and I'm sure you're familiar with, and that is that cancer cells also upregulate a lot of genes that are involved in autophagy, and they use this as a mechanism to help them spread, metastasize. I know that, you know, there's a very well-known inhibitor of autophagy called chloroquinone, which is used to, you know, kill cancer. So what do you think? I mean, obviously fasting is way, it's not just causing autophagy. It's like doing, it's this whole, like you mentioned, there's lots of the sensitizing the cancer cells and the stress response, but all these different things going on, causing the mitochondria to make more reactive oxygen species and all that. Do you think there's some sort of like different stage of cancer where this is, you know, autophagy becomes more important, like later in cancer when it actually, that's when the metastasis occurs? Or what do you think of that whole field of, you know, autophagy also playing a role in cancer?
I think the autophagy, and I think this was in the paper that was published together with ours by Guido Cromer.
Mm-hmm, Guido Cromer.
And he showed, and Frank Madeo has also been doing work on that, but Guido was showing that autophagy was very, very important during the starvation or using starvation mimicking drugs in causing the exposure of cancer cells to the immune system, right? So which probably means that that autophagy is really part of this weakening and maybe death of the cancer cells. Mm-hmm. So autophagy turns from something good in a normal cell that does it in a very coordinated way into something bad in a cancer cell, probably because it may break down components that are needed. I mean, I don't know, but, yeah, but certainly, you know, autophagy seems to be, you know, at least for this purpose, it seems to be very important, and probably the desperate part of the desperate attempt of cancer cells, mm-hmm, to get what they need from somewhere, and that's what we see that. In general, we've seen that for almost everything else, where, I mean, even independently of autophagy, the desperation seemed to be key, meaning that, for example, they tried to increase translation to get more proteins, right? Instead of shutting down like a normal cell would, they go and try to do things that they seem to be desperate. And of course, you can do that, and or you can do it only for so long. Mm-hmm. And that's probably why they die.
Yeah. I mean, I know it was something that kind of was confusing to me at first, and then I thought about it for, you know, a little more in depth, and I thought, well, you know, fasting itself is doing so much more than just autophagy as well, so it's not like, you know, that's the only mechanism that, you know, it's not, that's a current, a biological mechanism that's changing with fasting, so, but I just thought it was kind of interesting how it seems to be there's sort of this opposite end of the spectrum, you know, effects in terms of cancer. But you mentioned fasting mimetic drugs. Or what was it, fasting mimetic drugs or autophagy mimetic?
No, fasting mimicking drugs. So the Cromer had a series of drugs.
So which one, like, is there?
I forget now what drugs they had. But for example, resveratrol is spermidine are considered fasting mimicking drugs. They, you know, they may not have the power of fasting, but certainly they push the cells in that direction.
They activate certain signaling pathways.
That are similar to fasting, and this is one of the discussions with people that do drugs. I mean, you have some benefits, but of course you have also potential side effects, and usually the benefits are weaker than the ones that you get by doing the real thing. But that's okay. I mean, it's a reasonable compromise if you can get some effects, let's say, by giving spermidine to cells and organisms. That makes life much easier than having to fast all the time. So I think, you know, maybe a combination of the pharmaceutical intervention, once we know that they're very safe and they're very effective, together with this older type of intervention, may be the way to go. You know, but we have to be very careful because, again, in the future, and this I think has been underestimated by the aging community, which is to treat somebody sick, you can allow a certain degree of toxicity by whatever treatment you're giving. But when you treat somebody healthy, really, there should be no toxicity whatsoever, right?
Yeah.
Because now you just generate it, even if it was 1% of the people, they get a side effect. So in moving forward with these fasting, mimicking diets, and these anti-aging drugs, I mean, we work on it ourselves, right? But certainly, you really got to get to the point where you say, I know this will never be toxic to anybody. It's tough, right?
Right, it is, especially in the long term. You're thinking, well, feedback loops, all sorts of things happen. If you're perturbing one system, that's going to have so many consequences. Because everything's connected, you know, and how are you going to know 20 years from now?
Yeah, exactly. It's impossible, right? So you'll have to have the 20 years, right?
Right, yeah.
You'll have to have the 20 years observation. And for example, this is why metformin now is starting to very slowly move into the candidate position for an anti-aging drug. You know, Nir Barzilai and others are talking to the FDA about moving forward with it because there is so much observation. But that doesn't mean that even for metformin, where all the observation is for diabetic patients, and given to somebody that is completely healthy, that may not turn out to be to generate some problems that we did not see in the diabetic population.
Yeah. So metformin, in a way, could possibly say it's a fasting mimetic in the sense where it activates AMP kind, one of the signaling pathways that also activating. Do you know if metformin increases autophagy, or has that been looked at?
I'm pretty sure it does. So. Metformin seems to, in our view, seems to be acting more in the sugar pathway, but then of course it's missing the effect on the amino acid pathway, or it has a much weaker effect on that pathway. But metformin's got potential. But then again, will I take metformin knowing what I know? Absolutely not. You know,
about when you're 65 or 70? Would you start taking
way.
It? No, really.
No way.
Why is that?
Well, because. I just don't like the our laboratory discovered the taurocyst kinase pathway in aging 15 years ago, and we used to work with rapamycin back in the 90s, in the mid 90s. You know, we were working with the cells from Mike Hall, but I always said I never want to work. I mean, not never, but I really am not enthusiastic working by blocking something so central. You know, in a cell and its metabolism and its growth, et cetera, et cetera. And I think everybody got very excited in the field and you started seeing first all the positive results with rapamycin until, of course, you start getting the negative results, right? And it was hyperglycemia, testicular degeneration, cataracts, and these are probably just some. And I think with any drug that intervenes as such a central inside of the cell. I always say it's kind of like taking a car that has got a problem and just sticking things into it until you find, oh, the problem stopped, right? It's like leave the knife in there, you know, or leave the device in there. You know, that's not the way to do it, right? You have to somehow rebuild the car in a way that works. But pharmacology a lot of times, or almost always, blocks something.
Right.
It's like, well, when you block that, what happens to everything else around it? Well, I don't know. But 30 years of all that, let's say you activate the AMP kinase, right?
Yeah.
And then you change all these things. Well, what happens after 30 years of this interference? And then you do it in all the cells. Is it possible that this just disruption of all these normal pathways, it does nothing? I don't know. So we prefer, for example, we always prefer to go with where we have human evidence, then there are no consequences, and that's the growth hormone receptor, right? Mm-hmm. So we're now developing drugs against the growth hormone receptor. Why? Because we have the Ecuadorians that we've been following for 10 years, and Guevara, our colleague, has been following them for 30 years, and they're fine. They make it to very old age.
Can you explain that? So people like, you know, I don't know, the IGF-1 and growth hormone pathway.
Right. So essentially, amino acids, proteins and amino acids control two major pathways, right? One is the growth hormone IGF-1, and which is called an axis. It's not really a pathway, but an axis. And then the other one is taurus kinase, right? So if you have a lot of amino acids, those two are up, are activated. And both are now widely recognized as very powerful pro-aging pathways. So you could do it by food, or you could do it by mutation. So if you take a mouse and you knock out the growth hormone receptor, this mouse will live 40-50% longer. It's also, in spite, and this is work by John Kapchick and Andre Barkey, and in spite of living longer, it has much less diseases. So almost half of these mice will get to the end of life with no diseases that are visible, right? So it's really remarkable. And as remarkable, I think, is our work with humans that have the same mutation, the growth hormone receptor. And these people will live maybe a little bit longer, not 40% longer for sure, but they have a terrible diet. They smoke, they drink, they really don't watch anything they do. And in spite of all this, they almost never get cancer. They almost never get diabetes. We really haven't seen any chronic disease in these people. In the same households, they get normal diseases, right? So it has nothing to do with Ecuador. It has to do with the mutation, mm-hmm. which matches very well the mouse data. But I think that is a much better target. I mean, I'm biased, but I think having all of it available to us for a long time, and we picked the target that was the least likely to cause any side effects.
Yeah.
Also based on you know, very long-term human data.
There's also human data showing that there's polymorphisms in, for example, the IGF-1 receptor or that whole pathway, you know, that are also consistent with longevity as well.
Right. FOXO, there are mutations and polymorphisms
exactly.
in FOXO, in the IGF-1 receptor, in the growth hormone receptor. Yeah.
Right. It's all consistent
I
remember, in fact, one of my first experiments in biology was doing, you know, manipulating the IGF-1 signaling pathway in worms in Andrew Dillon's lab at the Salk Institute. And I remember when I saw, you know, when you get rid of that pathway and in these worms, they live 100% longer. I mean, it was like amazing to me that you could change one genetic pathway and cause a worm to live like 100% longer. I mean, that to me was mind blowing. Like, how is that? And these are genes that are conserved in humans, nonetheless. So it really makes you think, well, if this can happen to a worm, you know, what's the potential for humans? And we know centenarians have, like you said, FOXO. So IGF-1, just for people, so that IGF-1 is a growth signaling pathway that I don't, and maybe you can answer this question for me. When I think about it for human aging, I always think about too much IGF-1 being playing an important role in cancer, promoting cancer growth. When I was studying it in the worms, it was more about not inhibiting this very important stress response pathway, the FOXO3 pathway, and how that's important for turning on all these genes that are involved in making stem cells and autophagy and degrading proteins. And it's just like a master regulator of all these like amazing genes that can help you if you smoke or just help you deal with the stresses of aging in general. For humans, do you think that lowering IGF-1 is going to be have a more profound effect on human lifespan via like not getting cancer, or do you think the FOXO not inhibiting that FOXO3 pathway is just as important?
It's very much connected, meaning that the aging process is the driver for the cancer, both at the level of cancer cells and accumulation of mutation, but also at the level of the tissues getting more inflammation, be more permissive to the metastasis, and also the level of the immunosenescence and the immune system getting weaker And we know that if you have a immune deficient mouse, the cancer grows a lot faster.
Right.
So yeah, so then the aging process is really, and I think most of us agree, the primary driver of the age-related disease, which is cancer, and of course all the other age-related diseases. So yeah, so we always look in terms of treat aging, and then the rest comes. Now, of course, yeah, there are other things that might not be necessarily related to aging. For example, if you have high IGF-1 in the moment where the cancer cell is generated, that cancer cell might still love to have a lot of IGF-1 because it helps it prevent apoptosis. And so, you know, there could be a dual role of some of these growth factors in making sure that the cancer becomes a metastatic cancer. Mm-hmm. That, you know, some of it may be independent of the aging process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We should probably also mention the good parts of IGF-1. You know, IGF-1 plays an important role in muscle growth, muscle repair, and also it crosses the blood-brain barrier and plays an important role along with brain-derived neurotrophic factor for growing new brain cells.
Yeah, this is why I was saying the fasting and refeeding, right? So during the fasting, the IGF-1 goes down, and so does TOR and does everything else. But during the refeeding, IGF-1 goes up, mm-hmm. and IGF-1 is the driver of all this regeneration, and most likely, I mean, we haven't looked there in depth, but you know, other people have. And so almost in a lot of regenerative process, you see IGF-1 being involved. You know, and this is why I was saying that calorie restriction will have this chronic effect on lowering the factors, but never has the part B, which is after you lower it, you have to rebuild it, and that's why.
That makes sense.
And that's why I think it may be only half of the solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something else what comes to my mind as well is wanting the IGF-1 to go where it's supposed, instead of sitting around in your you know serum and you know in the bloodstream, but going to the muscle, going to the brain. And I know that it's been shown in humans that. It's been shown in humans that acute exercise, I think it was aerobic, lowers serum IGF-1. And I think it's because it's going to the muscle, also to the brain, because in mice it's been shown that exercise causes IGF-1 to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain. So that's another good reason to exercise, is because now the IGF-1 that you have, you know, is going to the places where it's, you know, it should.
Right,
maybe.
Right, yeah. So exercise, obviously, there's no doubt that it's very beneficial. And some of it may be related to the fasting, meaning that exercise is known to do damage to the muscle, right? And so that damage, and then it's known that after the damage, you get repair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also known that the repair is what builds the muscle, right? So this may be maybe not as potent as the fasting, but if you do it all the time, mm-hmm. it could be that you have all these small regenerative processes occurring every couple of days, if you exercise every couple of days, and then you know eventually those could be cumulatively, could be actually very powerful. And so.
Particularly in combination with the fasting too. I mean, if you're gonna eat your protein and activate IGF-1, then it's good to exercise to make sure it's going to the right place, right? And so it's,
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book that I wrote, I really talk about exercise and the need to exercise to make sure that some of these restrictions don't end up in loss of lean body mass. Because the exercise,
right.
especially the weight training, is very important in sending the signals to the muscle to rebuild it. And this is really another very interesting thing about fasting, which is, it takes the energy from the visceral fat, but it also takes energy from the muscle. But then, unlike other diets, it rebuilds the muscle. And so now, clinically, we see a specific loss of fat, only significant in the visceral area, and then no loss or very minimal loss of lean body mass, right? Because there is temporary loss, but then rebuilding, right? So it's really interesting. how, and this is why athletes are starting to become very interested in these fasting mimicking diets.
Right. Because, yeah, this, I'm glad
because,
you
brought this up. Because you know, most of our diets will get rid of water, muscle, and fat, right?
Right. And you want to increase lean muscle mass and decrease fat mass. I mean, that's
or at least leave alone the lean body mass,
right,
and decrease the
fat.
Now you have, you know, you're switching to a state that is much more beneficial to your athletic performance. Yeah.
Do you think? I don't know. Have you looked at whether or not mitophagy or plays a role in any of this? Because I know that if you're clearing away damaged mitochondria, or you know, mitophagy or mitophagy, I don't know which one. I've heard both, but you're causing, once that happens, much like in the whole cellular system, it causes mitochondrial biogenesis.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering.
Yeah. So we're looking at that right now. Yeah. So that's our current project, and we'll see what happens. But we're optimistic and
see what great. Very, very cool. So we talked about so much, Walter. Thank you so much for talking with us. So with these fasting mimetic diets that you refer to, either for people that are, you know, doing this for, you know, disease treatment, or they want to talk about it with their clinician, their oncologist, their doctor, whatever, these are available for people.
Yes. So there's a company that I founded. It's called El Nutra. And it's lnutra.com.
Lnutra, like L-Nutra,
yeah, N-U-T-R-A. And they have, they produce a product called Prolon FMD, and the product, I think, is on prolonfmd.com. And this is a fasting-mimicking diet that is being tested clinically. Doctors are now prescribing it, and so you can contact El Nutra and ask for it. I should say, for disclosure purposes, I don't receive any salary from the company. I don't receive consulting, and my shares will be donated to a foundation. So I absolutely have, you know, I just did it because basically the patients were asking, what can we do instead of fasting, right?
So you're not benefiting monetarily.
Not at all. Yeah, in fact, I think I lose money sometimes. Yeah. So, so I think
that's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was not a good position to be in to be benefiting from things we're testing. But so the company does it though. Of course, I help them a lot in trying to get this out to patients, but also trying to get it as cheap as possible, you know, so as effective as possible, as cheap as possible. And we're there, and hopefully soon enough we'll be there all over the planet. Yeah.
And there's lots of information there, like on the protocols and all that.
Yeah, all the information. So people usually have to go to a doctor, just get clearance from the doctor that they don't have a disease or a problem that otherwise prevent them from doing it. And then they get assigned a nutritionist or a dietitian, and they just follow them for the 5 days from the distance. You can do this at home. And the great majority of the people have no problem. But you just have to be a little bit careful. It is a powerful intervention.
Yeah.
And you have to respect it as such. So, you know, people, diabetics, anorexic people, people particularly with diseases taking drugs, they have to really, the doctor is the only person that can decide if somebody's taking drug, whether this can be combined with a fasting mimicking diet. And there are some warnings, but the company and the doctors will tell you about it.
Thank you so much for watching. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you click like and subscribe to my YouTube channel. You should also head over to my website at foundmyfitness.com and sign up for my email newsletter. I send out interesting articles, links to studies, updates on upcoming videos, and so much more. Also, all of my videos are brought to you by the generous support of fans, much like you, supporting the channel. You can learn more about that at foundmyfitness.com/crowdsponsor.